Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening on our website, 989fm.com.au, or on our podcast a bit later, welcome to you as well. It's really good to have your company. And today we have a guest in the studio. Mark Moran is a professor at the University of Queensland and the co-author, along with Alison Wright and Paul Mimot, of a recent book, Serious Whitefella Stuff, I quite like that name, which analyses how Indigenous policy made so far away, in Canberra most of the time, applies to remote Aboriginal communities. Now, Professor Moran has had years of experience working on the ground in many Aboriginal communities and also has a background in international development. The book delves particularly into five communities, Kawanyama, Dimiji, Mornington Island, Ali Kurung and Marpoon. He demonstrates how in Aboriginal policies, solutions often become problems themselves, as each new program exacerbates the complexity of the social problem it seeks to solve. I think we've seen this time and time again across the breadth of Aboriginal Australia, and I'm sure our listeners have their own examples of how this happens. I think there's a great deal of frustration all around the country regarding this. But right now we have Professor Moran in the studio to guide us through a bit of his book. Welcome to the program today. It's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Now, first of all, I was just wondering, what's your background? How did you sort of get into Aboriginal affairs?
Well, I studied civil engineering and then realised at some point that I'd probably made a bit of a career error. I ended up working in Lesotho in southern Africa, building village water supply systems, and loved that and realised that I wanted to do development work. And I was living in southern Africa at a time when Nelson Mandela was still in jail, and I did realize that I wanted to work in Indigenous affairs. So
is it that sense of we have our own problems in our own country, and yet there seems to be this perception that all the problems are overseas, you know?
Well, that's right. And, you know, it was quite clear to me that there was maybe something that I could do in Indigenous affairs, or I wanted to. I think many of the, you know, non-Indigenous people working in Indigenous affairs actually are coming from that sort of a place of wanting to help. So, so then I came back to Australia and ended up in Dumaji, working in Dumaji, which was what I like to call my apprenticeship. And I lived there for over 2 years. And then that just took me on this path. But I've always continued to work in international development as well. So I've sort of moved between the two and found it really helpful to bring learnings from international to Indigenous, and increasingly from Indigenous back to international.
Now, it's really interesting because in your book there's a whole chapter particularly on Dimiji, and I think you went there around 1991, was around the time. But you immediately saw differences in the way the approaches to Aboriginal communities compared to what you had seen in Africa, hadn't you?
Yeah, it was very different, especially arriving. I mean, before I went into Lesotho, I spent about 6 months learning a language. I had a very thorough orientation program before I even arrived in country. I read a number of books. Then when I arrived, I had a six-week handover from the person that I was replacing. And then I was expected I would stay there for 3 years and living in the community, which I did. And when I arrived in Dimiji, it was, you know, the noise of the plane, and then there it was. And there was no preparation. The people that were there had no idea about language.
Who were already on the ground.
Yeah,
and
of
even
course,
taken time.
You know, Dimiji people did, but the outsider that were working there, the school teachers, the the nurses, the people working for council, as I was, you know, I landed there and was to work as the council engineer. So it really was a school of hard knocks, and I made a lot of mistakes, but you know, really, as I began to form relationships with people on council, and I really fell in with a lot of the outstation groups, which is what one of the chapters in the book is about. Then I started to find my feet, and the people sort of took me under their wing. But I think a lot of people that come from international development, when they arrive in Indigenous communities, they struggle because they're not immediately welcome the way that they are overseas. But we shouldn't be surprised by that, because we really are completely unprepared.
Which is amazing, that there is such a difference between the way that's seen in a policy making sense for outsiders to go, and you would expect, you know, people, it just seems logical to want to learn about the language and the culture when you go into a community. That seems logical, but obviously it just doesn't happen in Aboriginal affairs.
Yeah, it's a, you know, there's so, I mean, I think this is one of the main points of the book, is that there's so much written about the capability building and leadership training for Indigenous people, but we've got a massive capability deficit as well with the outsiders that are going into community. I don't mean to question the skills of nurses or teachers. Of course, they have their skills to teach and to nurse, but from a development, taking a development perspective, it's much more than service delivery. I mean, every place has a unique context, a unique history. Mm. You know, different language groups have often been forced to come together. You know, there's lots of politics. There's enormous strengths. There's lots of problems. So if you don't, you really need to understand that context. And you can do Indigenous studies at different universities, which will give you a good sort of general introduction. But every context is different. Every place is different as well. So you have to have the skills of arriving in a place and working it out, and forming those relationships that are really everything on the ground.
I mean, there's one sort of funny example that you start with regarding Dimagee around sort of this thing you read in just a policy document put out by the Queensland Department of Aboriginal Affairs, I guess. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was a young Queenslander, you know, I guess culturally for me, I had, you know, I'd always learned to look people in the eye, and so I was doing this in Dimagee, and the department at the time released culturally appropriate guidelines for working with Indigenous people, and one of them was, you know, don't look Aboriginal people in the eye. It's culturally inappropriate.
And but it's just this, you like Aboriginal people. Yeah. What is Aboriginal people?
I know, but I was, I guess, young and wanting, anyway, naive and wanting to do the right thing. So I was mortified. I've been offending everybody for the last 6 months by looking them in the eye. So then I was sort of shuffling around with my looking down at my feet and being very good at avoiding people's eye contact. And then, you know, a few weeks later, I was in this ATSIC meeting, that's the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission meeting, where there were these huge regional council meetings, and they were very important. This was when big decisions were being made about funding allocations by elected Indigenous leaders. And I happened to be at this meeting, and I knew a woman who was there, an elder from Mornington Island, and I made her a cup of tea. And she started talking to me about this other white fellow who'd been in the meeting before me, and she said, you know, I just don't trust that guy. I mean, one thing I've learnt about white fellows is you can't trust them if they don't look you in the eye. And, you know, it was all I could do not to start sort of laughing at myself and laughing at everybody. Of course, there's no, you know, fixed rules here, you know. I mean, it really is what's you're working out with people face-to-face and being honest and listening and showing respect and, you know, those basic kind of human qualities is really more important than whether you're looking people in the eye or not. I think it's better to be yourself, really. Yeah.
It really illustrates that bigger issue that we look at, sort of the policy making at the top, and very, very much neglect what people on the ground are saying, which I guess is the whole point of your book.
Yeah, look, we have got ourselves into this, we as an Australians have got ourselves into this a really unusual situation where the sheer number of programs coming in to what are very small places is really crowded.
Mm.
It's not unusual for communities of 500 people to have 80 different programs coming in, and I'm being conservative. It can be many more than that. So, and bringing those numbers down to a more personal level, a popular area for programming is disengaged youth. So, you know, you can have 50 disengaged youth and you can have 10 programs that are working with them to re-engage them.
Yeah.
And these programs don't necessarily talk to each other, and they may have very different, what we call in development studies, theories of change. So, you know, one program might be working to force you to go to school by, you know, income management of your parents. So it's kind of coercing people to go to school. Or another program might be having focus group discussions with other youth, or, you know, or a kind of a case study approach, or you may have an uncle as a mentor, or maybe you need to spend time on country on an outstation.
Yeah.
So all of these programs can be hitting the 115-year-old and the 1 fortnight.
And it's just conflicting about the message that you're supposed to follow.
Imagine if you were in that situation. I mean, it would get pretty confusing, wouldn't it? I mean, which way do you go, and which of these which of these programs are working? So, I mean, at some point you do start to, and that's the title of the book, is in what I've heard many people in Doomadgee, especially when they've talked about the system coming in, they call it white fella stuff.
Mm.
You know, it's almost dismissively treated as all this white fella stuff that's coming in, and people struggle to make sense of it, and of course they would. There's too many programs.
And there's also the problem of we really don't know which programs are working before they're implemented. So how do people, I guess, how do policymakers evaluate that they're actually working? Is there a process, or it's pretty much just...
Yeah, look, this is a serious issue for me. I mean, I'm a professor of development effectiveness, so I'm studying how to measure whether things are working or not. And the sheer number of programs for so few people are such that it's not possible, I think, to actually measure how well these programs are working. Mind you, they all have their own measures. They all have their own KPIs, and they all have a strong accountability story that they maintain. But when you look at the aggregate effect, and we can see this with the closing the gap sort of indicators, is they at that level, there's the change is happening slowly. It, you know, there are improvements in some areas, but not in others. And I think that's why are all these programs working? But when you look at the aggregate measures, things aren't.
So each individual program might claim success. But
yeah.
When you look at it as a whole, but I'm just wondering if one program sort of cancels out the other program's success, you know what I mean?
We have no idea. I mean, we have no idea.
Yeah.
I mean, they could add to each other, they could subtract. We have no idea.
There's
complex hybrids developing between all these programs.
Yeah.
And there's nowhere else. I mean, I've gone to Princeton University recently and met with some of the world leaders in methodology, and when I've explained to them how do we measure all these programs, the consensus that's coming back to me is you can't. And what they're saying is you need to fix the system. You know, there's just too many programs for the number of people that are being served.
That's a very scary prospect when you consider the amount of money that is continually spent in Aboriginal communities, and yet we continually have these horrific problems, you know. it's almost circular. There's this outrage cycle where we talk about the poverty, we talk about the violence, you know, the problems that are coming out, and yet we have no understanding of what actually works so long after.
Yeah, that's. I agree. It's, you know, it's one of the reasons why I've written this book, is to try to create. I mean, I think the general general public knowledge around what's happening on the ground in Indigenous affairs is so different, you know, from what's really happening. And, you know, much of what they're reading is what they're reading in the newspaper, and that's often different. You know, there's a policy cycle, there's a political cycle, and often you'll often see running into an election that different, you know, Australian prime ministers or state or premiers will champion the latest solution. And, you know, they're doing this largely because they're trying to tap into this public perception that there is a solution.
Yeah.
And I think we actually, there is a lot that's happening on the ground which is working really well. And we need to shine a light on that rather than this policy making machine that just keeps churning out new programs.
Do you think the media in particular have been quite irresponsible in how they deal with Aboriginal affairs because of this reason? Because of they actually, you know, push this sort of cycle along when you consider they feed into that need for politicians to react almost. It's very reactive.
Yeah, look, I think, I'm not sure if it's the media or the politicians, but anyway, they're both in this thing where they're sort of bouncing off each other. You know, the story always seems to be in the problems and in the deficits and in the worst places, which, you know, which is understandable too, I think. I mean, we do have to respond to the you know, and there is a lot of problems and a lot of very troubled places. But the problem is if you design policies around the worst places, and then you then roll that policy out nationally or across all of the Northern Territory, then a lot gets swept away.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what happened with the intervention in the Northern Territory. I mean, without getting into whether the intervention was a good or a bad thing, for me, I'm not a believer in terms of what works or doesn't work. I think, you know, the intervention worked for some people and didn't work for others, and it worked better in some places than in others. But what it did do was it swept everything away before it. And those big policy changes, they have to discredit everything before them. So what happened in the Northern Territory is that a lot of people left, a lot of people that have been working in communities for a long time and had those relationships and had those experiences, they were seen as part of the discredited past. So they left. And also at the same time, there were the super shires being formed. So lots of local organisations that had been there for many years ceased to exist.
Yeah.
Now, my main point here is that we've got to stop thinking about the ingenuity of the policy solution, because there's no way the intervention was that ingenious that it justified wiping out the last 10 or 20 years of progress. If we continue to wipe out all progress because we have an ingenious policy solution, well, I don't think there is one. I don't think there is an ingenious policy solution. We actually need to be looking instead about what's working in places and building all the time on what's working in places.
And that was sort of one of the first insights, I guess, you've had, that you've sort of developed in your book around the four traits of Aboriginal policy. I mean, the first was that it purges, that it wipes away everything that was in its place, the stuff that was actually working. But there's also stuff around it's swinging, it comes and goes, which I think we see continually in Aboriginal affairs, these sort of jumps between different ideologies almost.
Yeah, so one of the chapters talks about the outstation movement at Doomadgee, where, you know, so originally there was a policy during the assimilation era of pushing people into the mission. So that was a policy of concentration, of pushing people into these communities. And then we had the outstation movement, which was the opposite, where the community was the problem, the site of all the social problems. So people were moving back to country. So it was decentralization out to outstations.
Now we're trying to starve people off the outstation.
And now then Doomadgee becomes a remote service delivery site. So it's now a hub community and all of the outstations lose their support and people are told they've got to move back to...
So you're going from generation to generation. Like, we're just talking about one community, Doomadgee.
Yeah.
You go from generation to generation. So the children have a completely different idea of what government's trying to make them do than the grandparents.
Yeah, yeah. So it's. I mean, these changes, you have to look over long periods to see them, these big changes. They tend to operate over 30-year periods that you can see these big changes. And we also swing between central top down and bottom up, you know. So, you know, we had the self-determination era, we had ATSIC, we had a lot of funding being decisions being made at a regional level, and then that the pendulum just swung the other way completely to during the Howard years of the, you know, the decision making being centralized in quite large departments. Yeah,
and then the next thing is you've talked about, I think, which is actually a really good point, is mimicking. So policy response, you might have success in one community. That policy is completely taken away and put in another community with no sort of changes, no looking at the differences on the ground that might not make that particular program successful. So that's another trait of what you found in the book.
Yeah, and so I think what I... When you, it is critically important to find where things are working, and but what you can't do is then package them up and then roll them out across the country, because every place is very different. But there are the people in that other place are in a position to interpret the success to their context. So we've got to capture the success, but not in a way where we turn it into a universal policy. We actually need to be looking instead at what were the success factors, what were the conditions that led to this innovation.
Yeah.
And when you look at that, you start to see things like connection to country and culture. You'll see strong leadership. You'll see the role of women in leadership. You'll see these relationships between outsiders and insiders sticking around for a long enough time. You'll see stability, you know, this simple thing called stability.
Mm.
In international development, international NGOs, the average amount of time that they spend working in a community is 10 years.
Yeah, which is pretty much you don't hear about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like the time it takes to go through school. I mean, that's the kind of commitment that you need in development. Well, it's pretty hard to imagine. I mean, at its best, you will see some policies being placed within a 3 to 5 year time frame, but typically they're operating on a much shorter time frame as well, often on annual cycles, and it really is we've got to look for these conditions of success, and they are the things that will transfer from place to place rather than mimicking, packaging, and then just transplanting it into the other place.
When you look at all these problems in regards to Indigenous policymaking, because it's obviously so complex when you unpack it, from your experience, have you seen any other place internationally where this actually happens, or is this very unique to Aboriginal policymaking?
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm actually looking for that, but I think it's quite possible that the level of institutional saturation, to use technical terms, the number of programs per people, I think, is probably the highest in the world.
That's disgraceful. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it seems like there's a whole big economy built around Aboriginal disadvantage. There's so much money that goes into it that sort of really the only people who ever benefit are largely the outsiders coming in. It doesn't seem to be people on the ground who ever benefit, because obviously we're still dealing with a lot of these problems in communities.
Look, I still think that despite all this, I know this, and I think some of the stories capture this, there is still incredible local innovation occurring, but it's not because people, and people are reporting against all the KPIs, against all the programs, you know, that they're doing that accountability business, but they're also doing something else in addition to that. So they go beyond the policy and program frames, and then they start to develop new ideas. So another one of the stories in the book is about alcohol management in Kawanyama, and it talks about basically three different policy waves that came in over a 30-year period. I mean, the first one was to have a canteen. That was actually a policy decision at the time to introduce canteens, which then led to a whole raft of social problems. And then the next phase was community-controlled alcohol management. And initially that sat with the council. But every time the council had a public meeting to talk about alcohol management, most people were opposed to curbing its supply. So the majority of people wanted alcohol. And the council, well, it's democracy, majority rule, so it was just playing the game by the rules. And then these justice groups were formed. Now, there was a policy to establish these justice groups. And this justice group came to be by a local process. This wasn't policy. This was a local political process. It came to be controlled by a small group of strong women. And then these strong women, they then started to introduce these alcohol restrictions. And then the government came in behind them and legislated so that they had the power to do that. And then the third wave was where the canteen was completely closed. And then the problem that emerged was sly grogging. And what you can see in Kawanyama is the police numbers doubled and then doubled and doubled again. And the policing became more and more innovative and effective in how they were operating to limit the sly grogging. So regardless of those policy frameworks, the interesting thing here is what's being worked out in practice. The fact that a small number of female elders got control of the justice group and did what they did, that wasn't policy. That was a local innovation. What's interesting here is not the policies. And I don't think there is a policy solution to alcohol management in Kawanyama. And now we're back to there being a canteen, but the council is the sporting association is doing an incredible job of managing that canteen, is doing really well. So regardless of the policy framework, what's interesting is what is being worked out on the ground in practice.
It really makes you realise how, because alcohol policy, obviously we see it debated in the media as well when it applies to Aboriginal communities. You saw the furore over the just blanket AMPs under the Newman government, the previous Labor government actually. So you sort of start to see how hard it is to actually discuss these issues in the media as a whole when we talk about the alcohol problem as a whole.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It just becomes very even more complex. That complexity, it obviously makes it harder to scrutinise Aboriginal policy.
Yeah, and I'm not sure it's because those kind of debates are happening divorced from the reality on the ground. So people are looking for that solution. But it's a very, very different story to what's happening on the ground. And why wouldn't we be really interested in what's happening on the ground?
You mentioned a bit about the programs that come in that actually, I guess, exacerbate the problems. I mean, how do we go about undoing that? Is that just too complex a problem to even begin to solve when new problems come in aiming to solve and to bring solutions, but what they actually do is create further problems?
Well, one thing we could be doing is creating some sort of an interface or a gate, you know, for were all the programs to go through first. And you know, there have been various initiatives to do this in the past. One way you do it is through an Indigenous organisation. So all the programs are filtered through that. So different councils or regional Indigenous organisations at different times have, to various degrees of success, tried to do that. Recently, the Empowered Communities Initiative that was, I'm not sure what's happened with it, it's gone a bit quiet, but the design was done, and the government seems to have backed away from that. But there was a significant component to that design, which was looking at creating an interface. So coming back to that, the example of these 10 programs coming in for the disengaged youth, at the very least you could just say, well, let's take it in turns. You know, you have a go for a year and we'll see
if it works.
See if it works, and then you have a go next year without getting in. See, every one of these programs has its, as I said, its measures of success, and it also has its political support base, both in community and in government. So they're very hard to, you know, say, well, what you're doing is wrong. So maybe it's easier to just say, let's take it in turns. Yeah.
What do you think the impact is of our political cycles, I guess, as well? You know, the Libs might come in and decide on this ideology. The Labor might come in the next election, although I think there's this really damaging bipartisanship at the moment. But do you see that as a problem as well, the different political cycles and the short-lived sort of political ambitions?
Yeah, and I think it is a tragedy that Australian politicians will sometimes play to Indigenous disadvantage to their own, you know, political gain. And yeah, but this is, you know, it is an issue of national significance, especially in remote communities, given the persistent disadvantage. So, you know, we do need to be. I just think it's inescapable, really, that's a dynamic that has been going on and will continue to go on. But I do think that politicians and service providers have got less reason to be confident about the solution.
Mm.
I don't think they have it.
Yeah.
And if they did, they would have found it by now. So maybe we've got to chill out about the solutions and actually just start looking at finding the places, the people, the initiatives that are happening in different places and shining a light on those.
It reminds me how many new dawns there were under the Howard government. Like probably three times a year there was a new dawn, there was a new solution that they were touting. It reminds me of that sort of rhetoric, I guess.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, we might go to a break, and after that I want to bring it back to sort of stuff that's happening right now around the Indigenous Advancement Strategy and sort of issues around service delivery. So we'll just go to a break and we'll be back. My guest is Professor Mark Moran, the author of the book Serious Whitefella Stuff.
You're listening to Let's Talk, presenting issues affecting the First Peoples of our country. Here's Amy McQuire.
Good morning. Welcome back to Let's Talk. We're having a very interesting conversation with Professor Mark Moran, who has a host of history experience in Aboriginal communities working specifically on the ground, and also a background in international development. And we've talked a bit about the international development approach, and you've mentioned a lot that Aboriginal policymaking follows a service delivery approach. Can you just tell our listeners a bit about what are the key differences, I guess?
Well, a service delivery approach, which really comes out of the social policy, welfare policies, it's driven by a process of identifying a problem or a deficit and then designing the program or the service that will address that. And then what comes with that is, you know, cars and people, and, you know, this is the way that it's driven. A development approach is much more about looking at a place instead of the one aspect of the place or the one problem that's occurring.
So looking at it as a whole, I guess.
Yeah, looking at it as a whole, understanding its history, its context, then working with the social community that's there. And there can be many communities in the one place, okay? So communities are anything but simple. And then it's really about taking an enabling approach instead of turning up with the, you know, I'm here to fix your problem approach. It's an enabling approach of forming relationships with community leaders and enabling them to take the lead. But it's not as simple as that, because what's behind you, especially in Indigenous affairs, is quite a dysfunctional system. So most of the people that are working developmentally in Indigenous affairs are probably spending at least half of their time getting the system to respond. So as hard as it is to take that enabling role and facilitate and support, don't underestimate how difficult that is. When you reach the consensus about this is what we're going to do in this place and the strong leadership around it, well, then you've got to get the system to respond.
Mm.
And that requires a lot of skills, and a lot of it is clever grant writing. A lot of it is brokering, winning over people in government, and sometimes it involves a degree of advocacy as well, where you're going to the media and you're applying political pressure for things to respond. It's a very complicated set of things that you have to sort of bring together. And this is a whole field in international development. I mean, more than half of the universities in Australia, you can get a Masters of Development Practice or Development Studies.
Mm.
And what you learn in these courses is a range of skills to be able to do this job of development in place. You learn things like appreciative inquiry or asset-based approaches, which is really about finding, you know, not looking for the problems, the total opposite, finding the strengths, what's working. And even in the most troubled place, there'll always be something that's working. And you use that as the building block, the basis of recovery. There's also things like political economy analysis to understand very sophisticated stakeholder analysis tools. And when you've got 80 programs coming into a place, you need the most sophisticated stakeholder analytical skills that you could find anywhere, and some of the, you know, the best people. I mean, gendered approaches to development, that is an entire field in its own, you know. Working with men and women differently in ways that where women are empowered and men are empowered at the same time. And I think some of the biggest changes that I've seen observed, and I gave that example before, that are occurring in Indigenous affairs at a community level, there's a gendered element to that. Well, there's gender studies. This is an entire field of expertise, so much to know in that space just alone. So there's enormous amounts that people could be learning from a development studies point of view.
I mean, it's ironic that Australian students, I guess, are better equipped to help communities overseas than in their own country, I guess.
Yeah, I'm trying to to address that, and I do think that for many years now, Prime Minister and Cabinet have been talking about doing some sort of a capability building program across its network, and I keep hearing it's happening, but it's taking a very, very long time.
Mm.
So maybe we will see some progress, but it's certainly something that can be done basically it's about building the capability of outsiders coming in, who are mostly white fellows, but not only. You know, there's also many increasing numbers of Indigenous people working in government as well.
Yeah.
And but they face a different set of capability challenges. But the getting the system to respond challenge is kind of, you know, the same for everybody, really.
And refocusing, I guess, on the capability of outsiders coming in, it's very important because the onus is always on Aboriginal people themselves and communities. When there's failures, it always seems to be blamed on blackfellas on the ground, when really we have to look, I guess, at different ways. You know, obviously there's a lot of cynicism towards outsiders coming in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we need to be looking at the capability of outsiders coming in. I mean, there's already a lot of programs that are working to build the capability of community leaders and, you know, community
members. The focus needs to shift a bit, I
guess.
Yeah,
I mean, but there's a, compared to that, there's a total lack of training opportunities for, so many of, you know, many, I think there's an appetite for, as well, for people to study in this area. And I guess what comes with study as well is a cohort of people that are doing this work who are sharing their experiences and their learnings. And maybe they're, you know, going on and doing some of this work that I mentioned before about capturing what are the success factors, which is a kind of almost an extremely applied research project of understanding what's working and not working in practice.
Mm.
So we could be building up a community of skilled practitioners in development in Indigenous affairs. That's something we could definitely do.
But I guess I'm very cynical. I'm seeing it going the completely opposite direction, I guess. Is that a problem? I mean, do you see it changing anytime soon?
I do think that I do think that we have reached a tipping point a few years ago, actually, in terms of the top-down approach, and you know, I think we have seen some really interesting initiatives, and it's a shame that it hasn't been supported. That the empowered communities, I think that design document is there's a lot of information, a lot of thinking and clever analysis that the Coalition of Indigenous Leaders brought together into that document, I think the Indigenous Advancement Strategy, despite its many problems of implementation, was an effort by government to reduce the number of programs. So
that didn't happen in practice, did it? I mean,
no,
talk about
it was good in intent, I think. Well, at least in how it was sold to people. The number of programs to be reduced.
Well, I guess they looked at the problem and they realised what the problem was, and they put in a place of it. It's just the implementation of it just did not work the way they went about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a real, you know, it was a big thing to move everything into the Prime Minister and Cabinet, and there was a real capability problem within government to actually implement that policy, and there was a real struggle internally, and the recent Senate review really talks about that struggle. But it was also accompanied with a funding cut, and it was also the things that could be funded was narrowed as well. So there are other things that were put into that change. There are lots of things that were pushed into that change, more so than just reducing the number of programs. So in a way, I think it was still kind of quite top down in how it was.
It was what you're saying about the contradicting sort of messages. I guess that's what the IAS was in effect, because you've got the funding cuts and then also, you know, trying to move everything to PM&C to make it better, but obviously it would never have happened.
But I do think that it's the intent to reduce the number of programs wasn't a genuine intent, and maybe we just need longer for that intent to come through. So I do think that there is, and as I mentioned, I do understand that PM&C is starting to move towards a training program for its staff. So I can see some things, But we've come through a period in Indigenous affairs where it's been quite quiet, I think. The number of evaluations are actually, much reduced to what there were previously in previous governments. So it's kind of hard to know what's happening, really. Mm. I mean, Indigenous Advancement Strategy is probably the exception. I mean, that has been, it's being evaluated and evaluated again.
Yeah.
But we certainly had a lot more information coming in under previous governments than what we have under the current government.
Well, I mean, I remember particularly with Labor under the Rudd and Gillard governments, there was this focus on what was supposed to be evidence-based policy.
Yes.
Can we ever have evidence-based policy?
It's a very fraught concept, and I certainly think that we need to maybe chill out about it. You know, like everybody is on a high horse about evidence-based policy. And as I said earlier, when you have so many programs coming into such small places and in all of these places, you know, you can't find a counterfactual, you can't find a control. Everybody, every remote Indigenous community has got lots of programs coming in. So yeah, it's because of this, the sheer number of programs coming in per person, we need to be more relaxed about evidence-based the claiming that we're measuring impacts.
Yeah.
Where often we're measuring contributions or we're measuring outputs. So there's a really important, there's some very important work that needs to be done to try, if we either just say, well, we can't measure anything at all, and then we need to chill out about evidence-based policy, or we need to take a whole different approach than what we're doing now and try to take almost a place-based approach to all these programs and putting them all together through an interface or through an Indigenous organisation and building it up around that place instead of the 80 programs.
Is that what you'd like to see happen first, I guess? I know it's hard to talk about solutions. We're just talking about the fact no one really knows the solutions. But I guess what would you like to see?
I think we probably need to look going down the road of an interface. I think we have to start to... I don't think there is a way to measure when there's so many programs coming in for the population, such small population centres. So we have to find a way of sorting these programs. And I think that the machinery of government drivers are so strong, it just can't be fixed, like, you know, somebody saying fix it.
Mm.
And I think that if it was that simple, it would have been fixed. But I think an interface could work.
And I think it's good always, we only got about 2 minutes left, but it's always good to talk about the strengths. And I think we talk so much about problems, but there's a lot of strengths in communities all around the country, isn't there? I think it's about harnessing that strength as well.
I think that there's the positive future in Indigenous affairs exists already. We just have to shift our gaze.
Yeah.
If we were to, there's so much happening under the radar, so much success and positive stuff happening under the radar of all these policies and programs, if we shine a light on those, start to capture that and use that as the way to build up things, it'll be a whole different situation.
And just quickly, what's next for you? I mean, you've written this book. Where, what's your sort of next project, I guess?
Well, I'm actually hoping to do more work around education, around both in international development and hopefully in Indigenous development as well.
Yeah, so, right. So yeah. I wish you all the best of luck with that, and I really appreciate you coming in. I think it was a really great discussion as well, and one that we'll continue to have as we continue with the program.